Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, we've been looking back at some of the biggest stories of 2015 through various lenses, such as the big stories in medicine and pop culture and sports, and through the minds of some of our favorite guests. Today, let's take a look at 2015 in criminal justice with Beth Schwartz-Apfel. She's staff writer for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization that covers criminal justice issues in America. Beth, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start off with a little bit of tape here that, in a way, I feel like really set the tone for a lot of the criminal justice stories we had this year. This is from President Obama, who back in July became the first sitting president to tour a federal correctional institution. And here he is.
These are young people who made mistakes that aren't that different than the mistakes I made and the mistakes that a lot of you guys made. The difference is they did not have the kinds of support structures, the second chances, the resources that would allow them to survive those mistakes.
That's President Obama touring a federal correctional institution over the summer. Now, Beth, of course, the president has championed sentencing reform and other criminal justice reforms for some time, but he wasn't the only one this past year. Do you think that the clip we heard is reflective of a change that we saw over 2015?
I certainly think that the last year or two, and certainly 2015, marks the first time that this country is having a serious national conversation about criminal justice. You had Obama visiting a federal prison. You had Hillary Clinton, a major presidential contender, making a major criminal justice speech in which she said it's time to end mass incarceration. I mean, even the fact that mass incarceration has sort of entered the national lexicon marks a major change. So I do think as a country, we're talking about it for the first time. Whether that translates into some serious policy changes, that's another question.
Right. I was just about to ask you about that because there was a bipartisan effort in the Senate, at least, for criminal justice reform legislation earlier this year. And what happened to that?
Well, nothing. Nothing so far. I will say, the fact that the legislation has made it as far as it has is a major turning point. The fact that Chuck Grassley sponsored it is also a major noteworthy fact. Grassley came into the chairmanship, a law and order Republican of the old school, lock him up and throw away the key kind of guy. And the fact that he sponsored this bill, I think, demonstrates a major willingness on the part of both sides of the aisle to take this issue on. That said, the fact that the bill hasn't gone anywhere yet doesn't bode well for its future. We're coming into the Republican presidential primary season.
I was going to say, an election year is a tough year to get major legislation through.
Especially with a front runner like Donald Trump, who's, can't be harsher on just about anyone. I think the Republicans are going to be playing to that law and order kind of base, and it's hard to see that bill going anywhere.
So we're going to talk about what effect elections might have on criminal justice in a few minutes, but I did want to touch upon another event that happened in 2015, and that had to do with the U.S. Sentencing Commission releasing 6,000 nonviolent drug offenders from federal custody just last month. The largest one-time release in U.S. history. The significance of that?
I think the significance of that in the end will be largely symbolic. There's something in the order of 600,000 people released from prison every year. So when you look at it like that, 6,000 is a very small number. However, I think that it's a really big deal that the federal system released all these people. Nothing terrible has happened, knock on wood, as of yet. And, the bill that we were just talking about contains a number of provisions that would be retroactive, where you would see large federal prisoner releases like that. And one senses that this might give both states and the federal government a little bit more leeway to try something like this again in the future and maybe even be more ambitious next time.
Yeah. So a lot of the conversation around sentencing reform has had to do with mandatory minimum sentencing. especially for those nonviolent drug offenses we were talking about. And actually, on Radio Boston, we spoke to former federal judge Nancy Gertner about this because recently she has taken up an effort to actually remedy what she sees are wrongs. Those are, in her opinion, of sentences that she had to impose on people who stood before her bench when she was a federal judge. And she talked to us about an example of the kind of person that she was thinking of men and women she was forced to sentence during her 17-year judicial career.
But if someone wakes up every morning, rolls out of bed, is himself addicted, as the vast majority of the people I sentenced were, rolls out of bed, deals crack, because in fact he was kicked out of school in the 10th grade or the 11th grade, also vast numbers of the people I sentenced were in that category, you can say that he did something wrong, but not 10 years worth of wrong.
So, Beth, can you talk to us about how, sort of, as you said, there's this national conversation going on about criminal justice and sentencing reform. Do you think that that might lead to any changes in these mandatory minimums?
If this bill goes anywhere, it does contain a number of provisions that reduces the length of mandatory minimums for drug and weapons offenses. The real sort of bulk of prisoners in this country, though, are in the states. And it kind of remains to be seen what direction states go in as far as their mandatory minimum reforms.
Right. It's an interesting point because, of course, Nancy Gertner was a federal judge.
Right.
But as you said, the vast majority of prisoners are in the state system. Okay, well, you know, we really can't talk about 2015 in criminal justice without at least touching upon all the stories we had about police shootings and police use of force. I mean, we could name all the names of the young black men who were killed by police in 2015. This is a tough one to get our heads around, but I'm just wondering, I mean, you're a reporter with the Marshall Project. What's your sense as to the year in police-related shootings?
I would say 2015 is remarkable primarily because looks like we're just starting to see accountability for the first time. The police involved in the shooting of Laquan McDonald, that happened in 2014 in Chicago, but they this year were actually charged with the officer who shot McDonald was actually charged with murder.
First degree murder.
He just pled not guilty this week, in fact. The police involved in the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore were also charged with various degrees of manslaughter and murder.
Although we had a mistrial in the first trial of those six officers.
We did. But it was before this year, it was practically unheard of to have police involved in the shooting of unarmed civilians actually charged in those deaths. And in fact, just this week, we heard that there would be no charges in the death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice. So that's not to say the accountability is piecemeal, but this is the first year, I think, the shootings have been going on all along. It wasn't until we started carrying around cameras in our pocket that we as a country became aware of them on the scale that we are now. And now, slowly, we're starting to see some consequences for that.
Yeah. So let's talk about another issue or perspective that's been changing in America on criminal justice, and that also has a particular Massachusetts angle here, and that's the use of solitary confinement, because Massachusetts is one of only three states in the nation that allows for the use of long-term solitary segregation, punishment up to 10 years for minor disciplinary infractions. And in October, we actually spoke to someone, Danelle Wright, who spent a considerable time in solitary in a Massachusetts penitentiary. And here's what he told us the conditions were like.
If it's 95 degrees outside, it's probably 110 inside of the cell. There is no ventilation. The water is just as hot as the temperature. And you may have a window that's about 4 inches wide. It may or may not open, depending upon how lucky you are to get a good cell.
Now, there has been some change about, or at least more attention being paid to how many people are being put in solitary, for what reasons, and for how long, hasn't there been?
There certainly has been. And it was just a few weeks back that the New York Civil Liberties Union announced a major settlement with the New York Department of Corrections to reform their solitary practices. It was also in September that a lawsuit in California resulted in reform conform to their solitary practices. I will say I'm gonna take a watch and wait approach with these reforms, as with any of this stuff. I think a lot of prison systems announce that they are reforming their solitary confinement, but if you dig beneath the surface a little bit, you start to see solitary by another name. The New York City Department of Corrections is a really good example of this. The Rikers Island, the notorious Rikers Island jail complex, they have 100 different names for different units that really, when you boil it down to it, are all basically solitary confinement. Mm. And so it's very easy to put another name on it, to move them to a different cell block. But it's hard to implement real lasting change when this has been prison's tool for controlling violence for so long.
Yeah. So let's just spend a couple seconds on the death penalty, because in 2015, we saw a very powerfully written dissent from U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, who a lot of legal watchers basically said in the dissent he was asking someone to send a death penalty case back to the Supreme Court. I mean, what might happen there?
And folks in the death penalty abolition community are working furiously to A, find just the right case to send up, and B, arguing over whether now's the time or not. You might recall a major death penalty case was before the Supreme Court this year. Glossop v. Gross was decided in June 2015, and the Supreme Court upheld Oklahoma's execution protocol. Now, this is the state that executed Clayton Lockett last year. This was the botched execution that horrified the world. And when their execution protocol went before the Supreme Court, it was upheld. So it's really hard to imagine the same court actually striking down the death penalty. And so many in that community are arguing about whether or not they should, heed Justice Breyer's call, because what if they send a case up and it's upheld?
Right.
And so that's kind of a big issue in that world right now.
And as we noted, he was writing in dissent as right. Well. Okay, so the last minute and a half that we have, I want to get back to the issue you raised earlier, and that is what effect next year's election year might have on criminal justice. I want to play two brief pieces of tape here. You mentioned both of them, but first of all, here's Hillary Clinton speaking at Dexter Avenue King Memorial Church in Montgomery, Alabama, earlier this month.
There is something profoundly wrong when African American men are still far more likely to be stopped and searched by police, charged with crimes, and sentenced to longer prison terms for doing the same things as a white man.
So one side there, one perspective, and pretty much as far as you can get on the other end of the spectrum, Donald Trump.
Well, I have to say this, in terms of our cities and in terms of the violent offenses, we have to get a lot tougher. Because if you look at what's going on with Baltimore and with places like Chicago, where you have great people, I know the chief of police, these are fantastic people.
So, Beth, in the last couple seconds that we have, in 2016, where do you see this conversation that we have been having nationally on criminal justice reform going?
It's a really interesting moment, and I'll be so curious to see how the politics pan out. You've got, on one hand, exactly as you said, people campaigning on criminal justice reform. And the other hand, presidential elections were always tough on crime was always the go-to attack ad, dating back to Willie Horton in 1988.
Yeah.
Exactly. So we'll see which way this goes. It really is a toss-up. It could go in either direction, or we could see a little of both.
Well, we look forward to having you back as the stories do unfold next year. Beth Schwartzat, full staff writer for The Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization that covers criminal justice issues in America. Always great to speak with you. Thank you so much, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
There's more of the show coming up in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.